Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm John Dennis, and this is News Desk on Thursday, December the 6th. Today, the wife of the missing canoeist says, yes, that is a photograph of her with her husband taken last year in Panama. The Guardian reveals how Labour Party officials and lawyers helped donor David Abrahams keep his identity a secret. And the governor and Baptist preacher Mike Huckabee goes from being a relative unknown to the front runner in the Republican race for the White House.
Mike's a principled, authentic conservative. Chuck Norris doesn't endorse. He tells America how it's going to be.
John Darwin, who was thought to have drowned in a canoeing accident 5 years ago, is being questioned by the police today. Yesterday, his wife Anne was quoted as saying that Mr. Darwin's reappearance at a London police station last weekend had come to her as a surprise. But then she confirmed that a photograph of the couple taken in Panama last year was genuine. The Guardian's Matthew Taylor has the latest developments.
She's been confronted with this photograph and she's basically admitted that it was her, it was her husband, and it was in the time that the photograph said it was.
If there was any wrongdoing on the part of this couple, it was unbelievably careless of them to have this photograph taken, wasn't it?
Absolutely. There are lots of things that suggest that this deception hasn't been thought through particularly carefully. It was incredibly, you know, careless of them to be seen smiling on a photograph with a date on the photograph in Panama, I think 4 years after he was supposed to have died, and she was supposed to be heartbroken.
And what does she say about the rest of her family?
At the moment, she's saying that she's in a lot of trouble with her two sons, Mark and Anthony, that they're never going to forgive her. In fact, I think the expression was that they're going to kill her. But it's been reported that they both left their jobs in the days before Mr. Darwin walked into the London police station. So I think the police will have some questions to ask them as well.
And meanwhile, Mrs. Darwin, any plans to return to Britain?
Yeah, in the interview in the papers today, she said that she's going to come back, but after she's tied up a few loose ends. So I think they're to do with property, whatever property, other property she's got over there. And then, according to her, she's planning to head back to the UK and face the music.
Could you tell us how this photograph came to light?
Yes, well, it's a really interesting story. It appears, according to today's Daily Mirror, that it was a reader of theirs who got onto the computer, put, I think it was Anne, John and Panama into Google, pressed return, and up this came. I think one of the first images on there was of them smiling away in a flat in Panama 4 years after he was supposed to have died off the coast in Hartlepool. So, it is an amazing story because she seems to have outfoxed not only Fleet Street's finest, but the police's finest as well.
Breaking news on Mr. and Mrs. Darwin at guardian.co.uk. And also on Guardian Unlimited today, a decision on interest rates. The Bank of England has cut the cost of borrowing to 5.5%. It's a cut of a quarter of a percentage point. Full coverage at guardian.co.uk/business. A teenage gunman killed 8 people at a shopping mall in Omaha, Nebraska. The latest on that at guardian.co.uk/US guns. And parents can find out how their local primary schools did in key stage 2 tests. That is at educationguardian.co.uk. How did David Abrahams go about using intermediaries to make his donations to the Labour Party? Our Westminster correspondent David Henke explains that in 2003, Labour Party officials and lawyers helped Mr. Abrahams set up the arrangement that allowed him to give £650,000 to the party in secret.
From inside sources, we're told that they got an approach from Abrahams' solicitor to draw up really an arrangement that allowed Abrahams first to pass the money to the people who were going to donate to the party and then pass this on to the party. And I'm told that two middle-ranking officials at the Labour headquarters in London shepherded the cash and then and took legal advice and decided that there probably was a loophole under the government's newly passed legislation to allow this to happen.
Was the law broken?
Well, the interesting thing about this story is that they obviously believe and think that it wasn't. And I mean, it's rather an extraordinary story. The government passes a legislation to make sure we know all the donors are. And then the Labour Party is working on a loophole in the law to cover up naming a donor. And that, as I understand, was the sort of centre of the situation and why It continued for 4 years, including under Peter Watt, because he was told that there was this clever little loophole to allow this to happen.
Do we know who came up with the idea? You know, was it Abrahams or someone in the Labour Party?
Well, that's what's really interesting. There is much speculation that Abrahams, who moves in circles in London with the Labour Friends of Israel and is a well-known charity donor, someone might have suggested to him that this is a way of doing it rather than him coming up himself. We don't know this. He may have come up with it himself, but there's certainly a slight suspicion that as this happened in 2003, a time when it was also the idea of giving secret commercial loans to Labour was also discussed, whether this was another idea.
How does this sit with questions about who knew what when inside the Labour Party?
Well, it actually is quite a problem for them, because it basically suggests that a number of people, the two officials, the lawyers, possibly other General's secretaries, although Lord Treisman has absolutely categorically denied he was General Secretary in 2003, that he knew about it, did know. And it also adds credence to Abrahams' claim that at least eight people knew. So, frankly, it shows that when the inquiry is published, there's going to be a lot of new revelations.
Did Gordon Brown possibly jump the gun in denouncing this arrangement as unlawful?
I think that is one of the other key points. And I've noticed he slightly rode back. He used the word illegal. And I was told that when he talked to Peter Watt, he was so furious, he was sort of more or less, Watt was more or less thrown out of the room, actually, in the great angry scene that took place. And now it will be, if the police, I mean, this will be really interesting, so whether it would be like Cash for Honours, that the police might wish to bring charges of breaking the law, and then the Crown Prosecution Service might say, well, actually, this loophole makes it difficult to actually successfully prosecute someone.
And what about the return of the £650,000 from David Abrahams?
Well, it looks as though, if it is right, that the Electoral Commission will rule that this is forfeited and can't be returned to him. And ironically, the person who will gain it will be Gordon Brown's successor, Alistair Darling, in the Treasury, because it will go into the government's consolidated fund. As someone said to me, what you're having is someone who set up an arrangement to cover anonymity and also make sure they didn't pay extra tax on the donation will have been ended up being taxed at 100%.
On this week's Politics Weekly, I'm joined by three giants from the Westminster jungle. We have Vera Baird, the Solicitor General, Matthew Taylor, the Chief Executive of the RSA, and Julian Glover, the Guardian's Chief Leader Writer. We'll be asking whether the government can move on from the funding row. We'll also be asking whether we can sleep soundly in our beds after hearing that Iran is not on the verge of producing a nuclear bomb. And finally, we'll be having our very own Vince Cable Lovin. That's Politics Weekly at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
Mike Huckabee has all of a sudden become the front runner in the race to be the Republican presidential candidate. He's got the backing not just of evangelical Christians, but no less a film legend than the mighty Chuck Norris.
Mike's a principled, authentic conservative. Chuck Norris doesn't endorse. He tells America how it's going to be. I'm Mike Huckabee, and I approve this message. So did Chuck. Chuck Norris approved.
The Guardian's Washington correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg, has been spending time with Mr. Huckabee. She says his support is going through the roof.
Well, it's just skyrocketing, and it's really the most improbable rise for a candidate who just didn't register on the political radar only a month ago. He is now first in Iowa, according to one poll. That puts him well ahead of Mitt Romney, the governor of Massachusetts. And he's near the top of the pack in several polls across the country. And you have to remember that Mitt Romney has outspent Mike Huckabee on the campaign trail by 18 to 1. So it's a shoestring campaign for someone who didn't have a national profile, and it really seems to be taking off, at least for now.
Well, how has he done it?
Well, Mike Huckabee is an intriguing guy. He's a mix of two things. One is he's a Baptist preacher, but he's really much more of a stand-up comic than a fire and brimstone kind of guy. So he mixes folksy charm, good patter, great one-liners over bedrock Christian values. And that seems to be winning over independent voters who like the gloss he puts over sort of hardcore conservative stuff. But also, and most importantly and crucially in Iowa, he is getting the support of evangelicals who make up anywhere between 30% and 50% of the Republican voters at caucus time.
He says his faith is inseparable from his politics. How does that work in practice? What are his positions on social issues such as abortion and so on?
Oh, well, he's dead set against abortion. I mean, he's quite clear on that. He has, when he was governor of Arkansas, a post he served in for 10 years, he did, you know, sign off on the death penalty. He did oversee executions. He puts a little bit of a spin on abortion that is different than other conservatives. He says he believes in the sanctity of life beyond the womb. That is, he would support welfare and other measures. He's solidly against gay marriage. However, he does support some things that might seem surprising for somebody of these conservative views. He says he's for controls, mandatory caps to help global warming, to help combat global warming. He wants more intervention of the federal government, maybe by example, rather than legislation on to make Americans healthier and to improve the school system. Here's one thing that, you know, I think should give everybody pause. You know, despite the sort of jokes, which are a little bit edgy, you know, sort of really not something you'd expect from a church-going man sometimes, he is very much a conservative Christian. And when I had dinner with him, he made it clear that he doesn't believe in evolution and he would support the teaching of creationism in schools.
Well, how has he managed to come from behind like this, Suzanne?
Well, as I said, I mean, he has the support of evangelical Christians. They have nowhere to go, really. From their point of view, Rudy Giuliani is beyond the pale. He's been married 3 times. He supports abortion rights. He's tolerant of gay people and gay marriage. So that puts him outside their frame of reference. The other main contender, Mitt Romney, is a Mormon, and that's a faith that's viewed with a great deal of suspicion by many evangelicals. John McCain, I mean, he is suspect from an evangelical point of view on social issues, but in addition, he hasn't even bothered to campaign in Iowa. The evangelicals didn't have very many places to turn. You know, Huckabee in many ways is their natural candidate.
But has Huckabee got the funds and the campaigning structure to capitalize on this current poll surge?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's hard to see that he does. I mean, he has done this in Iowa on $370,000, something like that, compared to the $7 million Mitt Romney has spent. He hasn't had many staff. He's relied on volunteers. So how do you leverage this into the national organization that's going to be required? I mean, remember, 1 month after the caucuses in Iowa, even if he wins there or comes in first, second, or third, how in 1 month does he then build up an organization in 20 states for Super Tuesday, the big deciding day of the primary season on February 5th? So he has to get off the ground in a hurry in terms of fundraising, and in terms of organization. He can do some of that on the net, but recruiting and building a staff and devising a strategy is going to be a lot harder to do.
That's Suzanne Goldenberg. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in today's news desk, plans to dig a road tunnel under Stonehenge have been scrapped. The Guardian First Book Award goes to a novel about an Ethiopian immigrant in the United States.
And so, the winner of the Guardian First Book Award is Children of the Revolution by Dinao Mengistu.
And our film critic Zan Brooks gives his view of this week's cinema, The Golden Compass and Southland Tales. But first, NASA's space shuttle Atlantis blasts off from the Kennedy Space Center this evening. Its mission? To deliver Europe's long-delayed science lab, named Columbus, to the International Space Station, as our science correspondent Ian Sample reports from Florida.
I'm standing on launch pad 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Around me, 140,000 acres of swampland, a few buildings, and a gleaming space shuttle Atlantis. Its mission later today is to deliver the long-awaited and long-overdue European Science Lab Columbus to the International Space Station. Earlier, I asked Alan Thurkettle, the European Space Agency's program manager for the space station, about the significance of the mission.
Well, now we will be having our own real estate on orbit. Columbus will be on orbit permanently. It gives us the opportunity to perform world-class science in a number of different domains, to perform technological research, to prepare for future exploration. It gives us opportunities for our astronauts to be on board. Every other year, we should have a European astronaut up on board for about 6 months at a time.
It's been a long wait, though. How's your team and yourself cope with that?
At times, we've had to be patient because there have been delays that have caused us to really change the shape of the program in terms of how we've implemented it. We've had to stretch it out over a long period of time. We've managed to do that and keep the costs completely under control. I'm very, very proud of that, and our industry has been extremely cooperative in that respect. I was lucky enough to be out at the pad on Friday last week before they closed off the payload bay doors and was within touching distance and swooning distance of Columbus, and it just looks beautiful. It's a very, very nice piece of engineering, and we're extremely proud of what industry have done.
So how's your job going to change now that once this cornerstone of Europe's contribution to the space station is put in place?
We're at the end of the beginning. We're now starting to do the real program. We have to operate it. And generally trying to make sure that we get good enough results coming out of this, that the user community is happy, the funding community is happy, all of the different stakeholders. We now expect to be able to go along to them and say, look, you see, you were wise, you did the right things.
Looking forward to the launch?
Oh, are you kidding? I'm going to cry a lot tomorrow.
Before the flight, the crew are kept in quarantine, not least to make sure they don't pick up any colds or other bugs before going up into orbit. I spoke to former ESA astronaut and shuttle veteran Thomas Reiter about what the crew will be doing to prepare themselves for the mission.
They are still in crew quarters. They have a last chance to see their families. It's called Wave Across the Ditch. They can stand on one side of a trench and all their friends and relatives on the other side, and they can talk to each other, but they are not allowed to get much closer.
What did they actually do in this time they're in quarantine waiting to go up?
They enjoy a little bit this beautiful weather here in Florida, of course, do some physical exercise. It's always good to enjoy the last hours here on Earth. The morning before launch, the crew has a traditional breakfast together, be it a big steak or ham and eggs or whatever. And then basically they need to get dressed up and get to the launch site approximately 4.5 hours before takeoff.
Now, the man in charge of ensuring a smooth launch for Columbus is NASA's Doug Lyons.
We start early in the morning, about 9 or 10 hours prior to launch, and we'll decide whether we should go into tanking or not. When we load our external tank, okay. And we load that with liquid oxygen, sure. And liquid hydrogen. And that's the big orange tank that's there. And we'll also look at the weather and make sure the weather is acceptable. And so at that point, we make the decision to go ahead and deploy them from the crew quarters to the pad. And we have 7 people out there called the closeout crew, and they help and assist the crew into the vehicle. And the crew is actually strapped in to handle the forces while they're going uphill.
So how's things looking so far for tomorrow?
It looks real good. The weather is very, very favorable. The outlook at this point is outstanding.
And now Ros Taylor's here with a look at today's papers. And the Sun's very excited about plans to build super jails.
Yeah, the Sun says this is a huge victory for the Sun. Of course, the Sun is always asking for new jails to be built, and we're finally getting them. Not only are we getting 3 new jails and a prison ship, which we've apparently brought from Holland, having sold the one we originally had, but these 3 jails are going to be enormous. Britain's biggest jail at the moment is Wandsworth, which holds about 1,467 prisoners, and these are going to be about twice that size. The Independent says that the prison service was inspired by super jails in South Africa. Apparently Martin Neri at the prison service went to visit them and was impressed by how well they worked. But some of the papers are a lot more sceptical. The Telegraph says even though these will be Titan prisons, as Jack Straw called them yesterday, they will not be big enough because at current rates of incarceration, the prison population will be more than 100,000 people by 2014. And in addition, it says it must have felt like Groundhog Day for Jack Straw, because this is tackling a problem which he failed to tackle when he was Home Secretary between 1997 and 2001. And he's being forced to return to it now.
And more bad news for the people that Jack Straw would presumably call Guardian Liberals: a crackdown on unskilled non-EU migrants.
This is something The Sun is also very, very pleased about. It means that if you're an unskilled non-EU migrant, as you say, you find it very much harder to get a job in Britain. You should be finding it pretty hard at the moment, given the measures that are already in place. But Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary, says it's going to become much more difficult. The Mail grumbles, says it's too little too late.
And happy birthday text messages.
They are 15 years old today, which is more than I thought, I must confess.
Absolutely.
I only started texting, what, six, seven, 8 years ago? I can't remember. Anyway, it turns out the first text message was not actually sent from a mobile phone, according to the Herald Tribune. It was sent from a keyboard, because back then mobile phones didn't have the ability for you to type in letters rather than numbers.
And Damien Hirst, famous for stuffing sharks, of course. Why is he in the papers today?
He's been trying to buy a collection of 6,000 stuffed animals. These are not just any stuffed animals, and they're certainly not very much like the shark cut in half or some the cows that have been dissected, for which Damien Hirst is more famous. It's a menagerie which looks a bit more like Beatrix Potter, as far as I can see. It includes kittens dressed in Victorian wedding outfits and squirrels smoking and gambling. There's a hamster playing the tuba in one of them. And
I like that in a hamster.
Yeah. There are 6,000 of them. Anyway, the story around this is that he wanted to buy the whole set, and eventually he didn't manage to buy it. And the collection was split up, and has now the 6,000 are no longer living together.
Many thanks, Roz. Don't forget the Wrap, our daily email service. You can sign up to that by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. Plans to construct a 2.1-kilometre tunnel under Stonehenge were scrapped today. Costs had soared from £223 million to £540 million. The government says that such a cost to the taxpayer couldn't be justified. Chris Woodford from the Save Stonehenge Pressure Group is delighted.
Well, it's absolutely fantastic news. We've been campaigning against this road now for almost a decade, and obviously we're delighted that the scheme, which we consider would have been immensely destructive, has finally been scrapped.
What impact would it have had on this World Heritage site?
Although the scheme was billed as a tunnel, only the tiny central portion of the road would in fact have been underground. The majority of the scheme, about 80% of it, would have been on the surface or in substantially deep cuttings through the heart of the World Heritage site. And at the eastern and western approaches to the World Heritage site, there would have been enormous roundabout interchanges. So it would have been a huge scar on an ancient and precious landscape.
The area does suffer major traffic hold-ups, though. I mean, what's the best way of dealing with this traffic?
Well, as far as we're concerned, this isn't an issue that affects only Stonehenge. Back in 1997, John Prescott promised that he would personally see to it that there would be far fewer journeys by car. And road traffic continues to increase. It increases every year. The only way to solve this problem is for the government to invest in public transport. What we want to see is the government saying, OK, we're not going to spend £500 million on Stonehenge. What we're going to do is put that £500 million into public transport schemes around the country and provide alternatives.
What about proposals to improve visitor facilities at Stonehenge?
As far as I understand, the visitor centre is entirely the planning permission for the visitor centre is entirely conditional on the road going ahead. So if the road has been scrapped, the visitor centre will not go ahead.
The Guardian's first book award is presented every year to an author whose debut novel is published in the UK. And the award is unique in that it's open to any author of any nationality writing fiction or non-fiction, prose or poetry. This year, the prize went to the Ethiopian-born Dinau Mengistu for his novel Children of the Revolution. It's a story about the dislocation and loneliness of an Ethiopian migrant living in Washington, D.C. The Guardian's literary editor Claire Armitstead spoke to Mengistu at the awards ceremony at London's Bloomsbury Ballroom. But first, here he is reading an excerpt from Children of the Revolution.
We decide to end our evening at a small, dark, crowded bar on the northwest edge of the city. The crowd tonight is mixed. A half dozen Nigerians, all friends with the owner, are pressed up against the bar, loudly ordering drinks and shots for one another. At the other end is an old white man with a beer drinking slowly by himself. Scattered throughout the booths and tables in the back are a couple dozen young white kids, the first to live in this neighborhood in 30 years. Kenneth and I slide into a booth and begin to drink. Joseph goes to the back of the bar and puts a dollar into the jukebox. We've been waiting for this moment to one degree or another since our first drink of the night. It takes about 15 more minutes before the song begins, and with the first chord, we raise our glasses and toast. When the refrain starts, the three of us lean forward and sing along. But you won't fool the children of the revolution. No, you won't fool the children of the revolution. Over and over, until the song ends, by which point we've all finished our drinks and are ready for another. The first time we heard that song, we were sitting two booths farther back. We still worked at the Capitol Hotel. Joseph and Kenneth were sharing an apartment just a few blocks away from the bar. The song played, and Joseph stood up drunkenly and declared, "That is us. We are the children of the revolution." His accent was heavier then, weighted with tinges of French that struggled under a formal locution to come through. It took him several tries before we understood what he was saying, each attempt punctuated by an emphatic thrust toward the air holding the music, and in holding the music, holding Joseph as well. When we finally did understand him, Kenneth and I stood up, and together the three of us nodded our heads to the words we barely understood, the refrain repeating its unintended sympathies over and over. Now, when the song is over, it's hard not to laugh at our misplaced enthusiasm.
And so, the winner of the Guardian First Book Award for 2007 is Children of the Revolution by Dinao Mengistu.
So what does it feel like to have won this prize?
Probably more emotional than I expected to win. It was sort of like immense culmination of probably everything you've sort of wanted and have thought about, and to be recognized with such a wonderful group of writers and in such a wonderful paper. It's an enormously special award because it's not. I don't know, somehow it feels like it's not categorical, that it is just your work, and that it involves people reading your work, and that it involves judges all at the same time. There's a real special, like...
So when you were writing this, you were unpublished, unread, would you have ever imagined that this could have happened to you?
Well, you can imagine a lot of things when you're unpublished and unread, and that's pretty much all you do most of the time is imagine. And that gap between imagination and reality is the hard thing to sort of overcome. And so to actually see what you imagine in your kind of wildest fantasies play out takes probably more time to recover from than I have right now.
It's a great winner for us.
Well, it's an amazing pleasure for me. The children of the revolution.
Dinao Mengistu, speaking to Claire Armitstead at the Guardian First Book Awards. Children of the Revolution is published by Jonathan Cape. Now, in a cinema near you, The Golden Compass. It's the Hollywood blockbuster adaptation of Northern Lights, the first part of the Philip Pullman trilogy, His Dark Materials.
There is a world where witches rule the northern skies, where ice bears are the bravest of warriors, and where every human is joined with an animal spirit who is as close to them as their own heart.
Are we going to see the child?
I should think so.
But this world is dominated by the Magisterium.
The Golden Compass costs $180 million and it stars Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig. Zan Brooks is the editor of Guardian Unlimited Film. I asked him whether fans of the Pullman books would be disappointed.
I don't think child fans will be disappointed. I think maybe some adult fans will be, simply because it slightly fudges the whole kind of anti-religious, atheistic tendencies of the Pullman books. You know, this is a big Hollywood spectacular, so there are going to be kind of compromises. And the books talk about a kind of the rational world and the spirit world and this sort of fight between them, and basically kind of pivot around this organization called the Magisterium, which is basically a kind of offshoot of the Catholic Church and is there to kind of stamp out any kind of free-thinking, emotional universe. That's all in the film, but it's slightly downplayed. It's all right. You can see it there. There's lots of religious imagery. You know, they walk around in cardinal outfits. There are kind of illuminated panels, stained glass windows. All the kind of imagery is there, but the actual kind of meat has been sort of gently stripped away.
How does this compare with other film adaptations of classic fantasy literature, like, you know, Lord of the Rings?
Well, it's all becoming a bit of a template, isn't it? I mean, this is basically totally in that camp. It starts out in Oxford, it looks like Harry Potter, then it becomes this kind of big battle with sort of big demons and talking animals and things like that, so it becomes like Lord of the Rings or Narnia. So I'm almost getting a bit sick of these films kind of coming out, these great big behemoths that sort of roll around every Christmas that have this sort of slightly pompous air, but great design and great kind of spectacle. But if you're going to have another one, you may as well have this. It's very well done. It's got a great performance from Nicole Kidman as this sort of villainess Cruella de Vil type. It's got a fairly decent child star in it, with the splendidly named Dakota Blue Richards, who plays a sort of 13-year-old girl, Lyra, the sort of the main heroine. And it's of a quality. It's a kind of decent, solid Christmas film.
And it's obviously the big Christmas movie this year, but other films are available. One of them is Southland Tales, which is Richard Kelly's follow-up to Donnie Darko.
The future is just like you imagine. Ah! Someone must be hiding it.
It's like the nervous breakdown of the century.
Nothing that a killer, a porn star, and a tattoo parlor can't handle.
Zan, Southland Tales got a terrible reception at Cannes, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And this wasn't even at Cannes this year. This was at Cannes in 2006. It was basically kind of booed off the screen. Cannes really revels in these kind of responses of people sort of storming out in high dudgeon. And Southland Tales prompted one of these very sort of flamboyant responses from all the kind of critics. Since then, it's been re-edited, but it's utterly disastrous. It's a real mess, but it's kind of a fascinating mess. It's Richard Kelly who did Donnie Darko, which was very kind of praised and seen as kind of a bit kooky. And I think the kookiness has kind of gone to his head, and he's just gone kind of right off the map. This is like this huge apocalyptic fantasy. It has Sarah Michelle Gellar as a sort of porn star. It has Dwayne Johnson, formerly The Rock, as this sort of bemused actor wandering through. It's got a film within a film. It's got a rift in the fourth dimension that scientists plug up with monkeys. And the whole thing, it shows how off the map this film is, that it needs Justin Timberlake to explain what's going on. Justin Timberlake provides the voiceover to tell you everything about this world. It's quite mad. And never entirely boring, because there's always enough sort of weirdness going on there that you kind of just sit there frozen, staring in sort of disbelief at. Obviously, we know he was entirely straight when he made this film, but it has a look of one of those kind of 70s prog rock albums that was made under the influence, and they had too much money, and they just locked themselves in the studio and went a bit mad and thought that they were geniuses. You know, it's who the gods wish to destroy they first make mad, and I think Richard Kelly's on the verge of destruction.
That's Sam Brooks. News Desk, which didn't need Justin Timberlake to explain what was going on, was produced today by Phil Maynard, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.